What else is a better way to start than with a movie? So, so let's just see a Monte Carlo simulation in action. Now, this is not a simulation of a sphere. This is a simulation of a torus. But everything works exactly the same. And the reason I did a torus here, because for a torus, there's actually a nice way to plot it in the plane. So you can actually see the torus. So there is a periodic structure here, parallelogram, and one should think of this side of the parallelogram, the other one being glued to each other, and these two as well. Okay. So we can just start, and we're just performing these flip moves. So here we're doing 100. Oh, okay, I should not press any buttons, apparently. There we go. So we're doing 80 moves a second here, so things are not really changing that fast. So we started with a regular lattice. I could have started with any other lattice I like. And we just continue doing this, and you'll see that the triangulations get more and more wild when I continue this operation. So I'm also increasing the speed a bit. So now we're up to 1,000 moves a second. So roughly every second, each edge is flipped on average. One can look at this for a while. And at some point, it will converge to some the uniform random triangulation on the torus. I guess you get the idea. Okay. No, sorry.
What's the shortest loop? What does that mean?
Okay, so yeah, so here, the shortest loop for me here is the shortest path that goes, say, from one side of the tetrahedron to the other side along the edge. Not someone else's. Oh, I see another. Oh, this one is nice too. Okay, this is too dangerous to do YouTube during lectures. Okay, stop. No. Stop. Close the browser. That's the best way.
But when you said it is uniform, what do you use to check uniformity?
Okay, so I mean here the same caveats apply as for the Ising model. One needs to have some observables. I don't want to go into details that apply to any type of Monte Carlo simulation. But yes, you would need to do similar things here. And clearly, I mean, in the computer, I'm not going to have an embedding and calculate all these things and do 1,000 moves a second. I would do 10 million moves a second. OK?
So the way in which the graph turned out to be later, right now, all of the triangles look equal size. And of course, some of them look bigger. Others look smaller, but then they're all supposed to be exactly the same size. Right?
Yes.
So that's just in the embedding.
Yes.
Okay.
It's the representation I choose here. But think of them as all the same size. Yes. OK, so what should we expect when we do this? Suppose we get this uniform triangulation. Well, we're interested in what happens when I take this triangulation to be infinitely large, like for the Ising model. We're interested in large Ising models. Now, for the Ising model, if you take your lattice to be very large and you're, say, below the critical temperature, it's actually a bit boring when you start zooming out. You'll see, if you take a step back and you look at your Ising model below the critical temperature and you squint a bit, you'll see just black or you see white. So all spins aligned or all spins, aligned, exactly. Or at above the critical temperature, you would take a step back and squint, and you would just see something gray, some gray noise. So the lesson there was if you're interested in large-scale phenomena in criticality, you have to go to a phase transition. Because then you get correlations which become infinitely long-range. Now, it turns out that in two-dimensional random geometry, we don't actually need this phase transition. Just this uniform random triangulation already has criticality by itself. So can we see this? So here I've plotted a uniform quadrangulation of 2,000 squares, I think. And here's one of 5,000 squares, 10,000 squares, 20,000 squares. So how can we judge just from these pictures already that there must be some criticality? What is the defining concept of criticality? Yeah, well, scale invariance, or perhaps at least structure on all scale. Okay, but usually scale invariance, I agree. So indeed, I mean, if you just look at these pictures, you see structure at all scale. I mean, if I go and stand in the back of the room and I squint and I've taken enough triangles or quadrangles, I'll still see some structure which is not just a flat surface or a round sphere. There really are blobs kind of connected in some way on all scales. So this system is already critical. So the only thing we have to do is to extract criticality, or the properties of this criticality. And an important aspect here is the universality. I mean, we expect that critical systems have universality when you zoom out far enough. So what is the universality class of two-dimensional random geometries? What are its exponents associated to it? That's actually something you're going to measure during the tutorial sessions. So how do we do this in general? So if we want to learn something about the universality class, we want to learn something about this geometry at large distance scales. Now, for the easing model, you might say, OK, so I have to look at correlations of points that are separated by a long distance. But here, we don't really have a notion of what it means for points to be separated by a long distance on a fixed lattice, because we don't have a fixed lattice. So instead, what we need is observables. Anyway, if we want to get numbers out of our simulations, we need an observable. But we also want this observable not to see the triangles in some sense. We don't want to ask, what does the neighborhood of this vertex look like? I mean, are there 7 triangles or 10? I mean, that would give an observable, but it's not something that we expect to tell something about the universality of these objects. So in general, what we need is a family of observables indexed by some parameter, say little n here. And this parameter should tell us something about at what scale this observable is looking at the geometry. Now, of course, we can also not learn anything about universality when we keep the size fixed. So we also want the size to become larger. So we have two parameters, the size of the system and this index of the observable, and we both want them to be large. I want to understand how do these numbers change when I take this limit in some way. This is the general menu. And we'll see several examples of such families of observables that actually lead to critical exponents. Okay? Now, I'm going to be quick here. I just want to mention that, of course, one can try to change our model. We're looking at uniform random triangulation. We could say introduce a different Hamiltonian there, so to make it a canonical ensemble, but not microcanonical anymore. It turns out if we introduce any action on maps or triangulations that is local in some sense, this will not change the universality of the random geometry. Another way to say this is that the phase diagram of two-dimensional random geometries, which we sometimes call pure gravity, is trivial. There are no phase transitions. If there were a phase transition, we could tune to this phase transition and hope to get a different universality class, but there are none. If we want phase transitions, we have to put something into the system. And the obvious thing to put into the system is a matter field, or some kind of system that we can use to introduce long-range correlations into the system. And a nice example is the easing model, which we now know very well. So one can replace our partition function, where we had just weight 1 per triangulation, by replacing this 1 by the partition function of easing configurations on my triangulation. I can sum over all easing configuration that will give me a number depending on the triangulation m. So this will give a non-trivial Boltzmann weight for the triangulations. And indeed, it turns out if you take such a statistical system, which you would usually put on a regular lattice, now you put it on such a random lattice, and you tune it to a phase transition, then at this phase transition, you actually change the critical behavior of the whole system. So not just the matter itself, but also the geometry. And this can bring you outside of the universality class of pure gravity. And in fact, it's why do you believe that so there is not just this one single universality class, but there is a one-parameter family of universality classes of random geometry. And it's this single parameter depends on what kind of matter fields you couple to it. Often it's taken to be the central charge, some number one can associate to matter fields. Having no matter means central charge zero. Easing model, for instance, has central charge 1/2. So there is something like the Easing random geometry universality class. So why am I telling you this? Well, this black box that I'll be giving you in the tutorial actually spits out not just pure gravity random geometries, but any of four different models, four different types of matter one can couple to these random geometries. And they should all describe a different universality class. And the goal for you will be to measure some exponents and actually see that they differ for all these four. And hopefully kind of estimate what the central charge actually is of the matter that I secretly put in. Okay, we'll get to that. Now, I don't want to go into how to simulate the Easing model in a random triangulation, so I won't have the time. But essentially, basically, one can supplement the flip move by the Easing update move and make sure that both of them together satisfy detailed balance and one can use the experience from Monday in the tutorial session to actually do this. Okay, so let me mention some observables that fit into the class that I mentioned before. And the most obvious one is to look at distances in these geometries. Now, there are various notions of distance. And I mentioned the distance that comes from the Euclidean structure that I put on all these faces. But it's not so easy to work with in the computer. Instead, if I have two vertices of my map, it's easier to ask for the graph distance. So I interpret my map as a graph. And I just ask, well, what is the shortest path on the edges of the map that connects two vertices? And I say that every edge is length 1. So these two points have distance 3. This is graph distance, I call this. And there is a natural adapted notion, which is the Joule graph distance, which says that I'm looking for the shortest path between one face and another face, where at each step I'm allowed to jump to an adjacent face. So these faces have dual graph distance 1, 2, 3, 4. Right? So if I sample a random triangulation of a certain size, and I have two points in there, then there are various ways of measuring its distance. I can use the Riemannian distance, graph distance, dual graph distance. But in light of the universality, we do not expect this to make any difference. I mean, so here I kind of did an artist impression of these three different connecting paths. Now they look fairly similar, right? On small scales, they might deviate a bit from each other. But actually, one can prove if you take a uniform triangulation, then any of these distances one can define, they are the same at when you take the points to be separated quite far. Except, I mean, they're not the same. They're the same up to an overall factor. I mean, one can be like 1.3 as long as the other. But this 1.3 will be fixed. I mean, if I take any two other points and I ask for the ratio of their distances, again, there will be 1.3. Okay, so in practice, graph distances are much easier to handle in the computer than Riemannian distances. And the standard way to do this for, say, the dual graph distance is, so suppose this is my starting vertex and I want to know the distance to this phase, that I do at exploration, which is called a breadth first exploration, where I label the starting phase by zero, and then I visit all its neighbors, label it by one, visit the neighbors of the neighbors, they will be at distance two, the neighbors of those neighbors will be at distance three, and oh wait, okay, now I've discovered the point I wanted to go to, so it has distance three. So this is, you can implement this really fast on the computer. Okay, so what can we do with this distance? I mean, this does not define an observable yet, right? I mean, a distance is a distance between two points, and I don't have a notion of points directly in the system. I mean, remember, an observable had to be something that assigns a number to these permutations. And I also requested that the number should be independent under changing the labels in this permutation. So how do we do this? Well, one thing we can do is we can take any function of some n times n minus 1 over 2 real parameters and mapping it to another real parameter, real number. And then given any triangulation m, we're going to sum over all possible points or triples, say, of points for n equals 3 in this space. So maybe these points are actually faces, so summing over all triples of faces of this function f evaluated at the distance between x1 and x2, x1 and x3, x2 and x3. So if I do this summation, then certainly this is an observable, and it's also independent under relabeling because I'm not actually using the labeling here. Or in a sense, since I'm summing over all possible faces, this already takes into account that if I change the labels on the faces, that this will not change the sum. Okay, one can normalize this. So any such function actually gives rise to a number associated to a triangulation. So it's an observable. And we can ask, what is its expectation value? Now, of course, this is a kind of a large class, and most of them are not that interesting. The simplest case is to look at the function f that is just the Kronecker delta. So I fix some parameter r, and I only take it to be equal to 1 when the distance between my points is equal to r. So that's a function, right? This is a one-parameter family of functions depending on r. So I can take the expectation value of this function. I define that to be rho n of r. And so what does this mean? If I would measure this in my random triangulation, it would say I pick a random point in my random triangulation, say x1. And I'm going to ask for the expected number of points that sit at distance r from this x1. I can also say if I sum rho n r over r 0, 1, 2, 3, up to 10, then the sum of this would be the expected number of faces that sit within distance 10 from my randomly chosen face. And that's a number, right? Yeah. It's something one can measure, and it's something you're going to measure. And this is what it would look like. Yes, okay, so this would be the probability that two vertices are at distance r. So if I multiply this by n, it's the expected number of second vertices that are at distance r. Right? So if I plot n times rho n as function of r, and I look, say, here, so this is for a triangulation of 200 triangles, then this graph tells me that the expected number of vertices at distance 6 from my randomly chosen vertex is roughly 30. Right? So there are 30, typically 30 vertices that are at distance 6 from some starting point. Is it kind of clear what this means? So clearly, if I then increase the system size, typically points will be further away from this randomly chosen initial point. And it will be some distribution. Now, what do we expect this distribution to look like when I take n to be infinitely large? Well, you can already see it happening a bit here. If you look just at the number of vertices at distance 3, then if I increase the system size, it increases a bit and then a little bit. But going from, say, 400 to 800 triangles, I can't even see the difference. So in fact, this distribution should converge to some line. You expect the number of vertices at a certain distance actually converges when I take my triangulation to be infinitely large. So what would this distribution look like for the infinitely large triangulations? It would grow like some power law. And this power law gives rise to a critical exponent that we call the Hausdorff dimension. Yes?
So this is the circumference of a circle with a certain radius, right?
In principle, yes, if the circumference would really just be one circle. Yeah, so if I would do this in the plane, so I know, so in suppose this would just be the regular lattice. So then I'm looking at points at distance r from the initial point. And indeed, we would expect this to be roughly pi times, or 2 pi times r. So that's roughly the circumference, right? I think random geometries are always easier than deterministic ones. Yes, but in general, what can happen is that, okay, so if I have a random geometry here, and I look at the distance r, then it can have multiple boundaries. And it's the sum of the circumferences of all the boundaries, yes. Yes. Yeah, so these are finite size effects. Like in the Ising model, where you also see finite size effects. But by just looking at the convergence to this line, we're kind of forgetting about all the finite size effects. Now in principle one can try to fit this the curve it approaches to, but this is usually not the best way to do it. And in the Ising model, we've seen a better way to do it, which is using finite size scaling. So one expects that, OK, let me mention also one more thing. Why do we say this is the Hausdorff dimension? Well, so this is Z2. So we would say the square lattice has dimension 2. And indeed, this goes like R to the Hausdorff dimension minus 2, if the Hausdorff dimension being equal to 2. So we call it dimension because a regular lattice of that dimension has Hausdorff dimension equal to that dimension. Okay. Now a different thing one can do is to look at the full profile that we measure and try to collapse the curves for different system sizes. Now what we expect is that if we have this scaling for the Hausdorff dimension, and we take two random vertices in this random geometry, then typically the distance between those vertices should be the system size to the power 1 over dh. I mean, think of the square lattice here. If I have this square, and I would pick two random points in the square, I would expect the typical distance to be square root of the volume of the square, right? L, so n is L squared. If I take two random points, they should roughly be a distance L, which is the square root of n, which is n to the 1 over dh. I hope you agree on that. Yeah, it should be okay. So more generally, we expect if we take the full distribution of the distances between two random points and we rescale it by this typical distance, that actually when I take n to infinity, this full distribution should converge to something. And this is the same as saying that if I have this Hausdorff dimension dh, then if I rescale the distance parameter by n to the 1 over dh, that the distribution should converge to a continuous distribution. Now, the reason we have also n to the 1 over dh here is that this is a density, so if I do the integral over dx, it should add up to 1. It's a probability. So when we can do this, we can just measure these distributions for each volume n, and then we just choose some parameter d, and we plot the curves for different system sizes as function of this parameter d, and we look for the plot where the curves are on top of each other in the best way. Okay, I think I have to be quick. How many minutes?
2+.
2+. Yeah, we started 3 minutes late for the second section. Okay. So that's the Hausdorff dimension. We heard a bit about the spectral dimension yesterday in Lisa's talk. So let's see how we would define it on these random geometries. So we're going to consider a random walker. So this is the little star. The star is a bit drunk, so at every step it goes in either of the four directions. And we just track what path it takes. And as soon as it comes back to its starting point, we ring a bell. And we define the return probability px of t, so t is some integer, as the probability, so x is one of these phases, say, that my random walker started at x is back at the origin after t steps. This is a well-defined probability. I can turn it into an observable by just summing this probability over all starting points x. So now again, we have an observable which has a parameter t, which is supposed to probe this random geometry at different scales. I mean, if I wait for 100,000 steps, then I'm surely not just going to explore the very little neighborhood of the random geometry, but some much larger neighborhood. So we're going to plot these expectation values as a function of t. So this is a logarithmic plot. And then one actually notices that for different system sizes, again, these things converge to something. It seems to be a power law behavior. And the exponent in the power law is called the spectral dimension of my space. And again, if I would do this on the two-dimensional square lattice, then the spectral dimension would be equal to 2, meaning that the return probability in two dimensions falls off like t to the minus 1, which is indeed the case. So that's our definition of the spectral dimension. And there is actually an easy way to compute it in Mathematica using linear algebra. One can define a matrix Aij, which is just the probability that the random walker, when he is at position j, jumps to position I. Since he just takes a direction uniformly, the probability that this happens is 1 over the degree of the phase j where he started. And okay, it might have my two phases might be glued along multiple edges, so we have to introduce a number of edges that's shared by these. So this is just probability of going from j to I. And since this is a matrix, I can take some power of this matrix, and that would give me the probability of going from j to I in t steps. So that's the tth power of this matrix. And then the return probability is just what sits on the diagonal of this matrix. If I want to sum this over all starting points, I have to sum over all values on the diagonal, which is the trace. And if you want to compute the trace of some matrix to some large power, well, we might as well first diagonalize it. So we take the eigenvalues, the spectrum of A, and then this trace is just given by a sum over all the eigenvalues to the tth power. So sometimes it's actually useful to just compute the spectrum first, and then for any value of t you like, you just perform the sum. Okay. I'm going to skip, I think my 3 minutes are... Okay, so this is the final thing I want to show. So in principle, now you know how to measure Hausdorff dimension and spectral dimensions. And it would be nice to actually measure these on the various models that my program is spitting out. And I said that the values of these exponents would depend on the universality class. And it's conjectured that this universality class depends on one parameter, the central charge. And there are some conjectured formulas for how these exponents depend on the central charge. So now you're going to measure these exponents and compare these values and see where these models fit in this line. So there are actually four models, and they will be somewhere scattered, and I hope you'll discover which one sits where. Okay, so there are various other things one can do. Okay, so there is the, here is where you get the program. I've provided a Mathematica notebook that can interact with the program, then you can immediately start doing data analysis. But you can also, if you like, write your own computer program to interact with it. I've put an example C++ file that interacts with the black box, if you prefer that. So the goal will be to look at these geometries. You can also plot them, get nice pictures. You like that, I guess. You can measure these critical exponents. And that would be today's goal. Tomorrow's goal, I would like you to be creative and try to think of your own observable and actually do data analysis on that. But we'll go into more details then. And towards the end of the second tutorial session, I would like to gather some of the results you've gotten. Because actually, not three of these models have been studied very widely, numerically and analytically, but one of them, As far as I know, nobody has ever studied numerically. So you're going to be the first ones doing this. So actually, I want to know what these critical exponents are, and you're going to tell me. And then we're going to write a paper with 59 co-authors. Okay. Very well. So that's what I wanted to say. It's the end of today's lecture. Questions?
There was one thing that was not very clear to me. If you put your Ising model on the random geometry, does the update moves on the Ising part and the geometry commute? Is this system talking to each other? If so, how?
They don't commute, but there is no need for them to commute in the detailed balance picture. And yes, they talk to each other in the sense that, well, certainly the Ising model depends on kind of the connectivity of the lattice it sits on. I mean, it certainly has some effect. But on the other hand, when I try to do a flip move, the Boltzmann weight corresponds to the energy of the Ising model. So if I do a flip move, this energy of the Ising model might change, so I have to introduce Metropolis acceptance probabilities to take this into account. And that's how it affects the triangulation.
Is there a way to modify the algorithm to only have, for example, convex structure? Like, is it possible?
What is convex? In this setting?
Yeah, the surface that you get.
You mean when I embed it in three dimensions?
Yeah, it's like, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, the embedding in three dimensions is not really part of the system. That's just my visualization.
I'm just asking if, from the point of view of the permutation, there is like some nice way of doing it, like encoding geometric property into the permutation.
Well, I mean, of course, you could choose to enrich your statistical system with data on the triangulations that tell you something about the embedding of this surface into some other space. And you could cook up models for that. But it gets quite a bit more involved when you do that.
Let's have coffee.
Yes, coffee.